Good morning and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco, and I'm joined in studio today by the PG's Ray Fittipaldo and 93.7 The Fan evening host Andrew Filippone. Guys, on this week's show, we're going to take a look at the Penguins and the playoff picture as we prepare for the final week of the regular season, a look at the Final Four with a little bit of Pitt spring football thrown in, and we'll also get out the crystal ball and make some predictions for the baseball season, which starts today. Ray, the Penguins played. Let's go with the Penguins first. Ray, the Penguins played the Lightning on Thursday, and that's probably going to be our first round opponent. I mean, that's the way it looks. You know, they lost 2-1. Game when Ray, I just think they have such trouble, and the power play looks so bad. But let me get your reaction on that. How do you like that matchup for the Penguins? Looking at it right now, if the Penguins hang on to fourth place and get the home ice.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was an okay matchup before the game Thursday, and it still might be. You know, the Lightning haven't exactly been great down the stretch. The Penguins dominated that game in so many facets on Thursday night. They dominated offensive zone time. They added a lot more shots than the Lightning. But the Penguins' offense just doesn't strike fear into anyone. And even though they were getting a lot of shots on Rolison, I actually thought the Lightning had the better of the scoring chances. Mm-hmm. In the limited number of chances they did have on Fleury, I thought Fleury had to make two or three really, really good saves to keep that a 2-0 game for the mm-hmm. longest time until Rupp scored. So, as you said, until the Penguins get this power play figured out, you know, I'm not banking on them making a deep run. They got to, especially with Crosby out, they got to get that power play straightened out. They got to make teams pay for taking penalties in the playoffs.
Yeah.
There aren't many teams in the Eastern Conference playoff picture right now that I think I'd really want to play, if that makes any sense. You know, I look at the field of teams that are going to make it out of the East, and I think what I'd want the Penguins to see in the other side is a team that probably is going to take is going to look at the Penguins as a team that they're supposed to beat and might take them lightly. You know, mm-hmm. even though Washington, they're not going to have a first-round matchup with Washington, but yeah. I'll use them as the example here. You know, if the Capitals had the Penguins in the postseason, I think the Capitals would look at it as, not maybe not a bye, but this is exactly what we need to finally get to a Stanley Cup. We're going through the Penguins mm-hmm. in the year that they're without their two-star centers, and it would almost be like a stars aligning thing for them. And I think the Penguins would relish that role, an underdog role, and the chance to kind of play spoiler against a team that has a tendency to get really tight in the playoffs. Tampa, on the other hand, they might, it's perceived that they have a lack of playoff experience, but they've got two guys that have been on Stanley Cup winning teams before, and LeCavalier and St. Louis, and Rolison's played in a Stanley Cup. And plus, you know, I think kind of ignorance is bliss for them. And you've got Stamkos, who's 21, and he's never been in the playoffs mm-hmm. before. You've got Hedman, that's young. I think there's something to be said about the danger of that, that they don't know that they're supposed to go out in the first round. They don't know that they're supposed mm-hmm. to be one and done in the playoffs. And given their ability to put the puck in the back of the net, I think the Lightning, they could do worse out of a first-round matchup, but I wouldn't favor the Penguins to beat the Lightning in the first round.
Even if with right now the series split 2-2, both home ice, both teams won on home mm-hmm. ice. Right. So theoretically, in a seven-game series, gives the Penguins a very slight edge if they finish fourth. But, Andrew, I you mentioned the East, and more of an overview on the East. To me, the worst matchup for them in the first round would be Montreal. I think it would be worse than Tampa, only because I think that matchup doesn't work for the Penguins. I think it's terrible.
Well, but Montreal plays more at their pace, don't they, Ray? I mean, if there's a team out there that matches them in terms of what they maybe want to do in a playoff series, I would say the Canadiens right now probably mirror that the most, which is low-scoring hockey games, get really quality goaltending, and win that way. Tampa scoring, Washington more defense this year than mm-hmm. in the past, but I still look at them as a team that's going to score goals to win. And Montreal has a history against them, and they've dominated them this year. But you know, if you're going to – there aren't many dynamic goal scorers on this game, and I think you might have a better shot at winning 1-0, 2-1 games mm-hmm. against Montreal than maybe anybody else in this field.
Well, Montreal – they do play – that's the way the Penguins want to play without mm-hmm. Crosby. But I think it's a psychological thing with the Penguins. You know, just even though the goaltender has changed, you know, the Canadiens just played them really, really well in the playoffs last year. And I think from a psychological standpoint, that is a series the Penguins want to avoid. You know, so I'm with Andrew on this one. This isn't a terrible matchup for the Penguins in the first round. I wouldn't be surprised to see them win a series or two, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them losing five games too without Crosby mm-hmm. coming back. I think it's that type of a playoff season with the uncertainty with Sid out.
I think that without Crosby, it's going to be tough for them to get through two rounds of the playoffs in the East. I do. Only because they could, I guess there's a way that, like, I think if they play Boston in the second round, that's going to be an extremely tough matchup for them. Although they beat Boston up in Boston Garden earlier. I guess it's TD Bank Garden. I'm sorry.
It's okay. We'll forgive you.
There. It's Boston Garden to me. You know, and they played well. And Tim Thomas is a great goalie, but I just think it would be very tough for them if they had to face a team like Boston.
Well, I think it would be. I think it's hard to see them winning. You say two series. I think winning one will be a struggle for them. Don't you?
I think they can win one series. I don't think they can win two.
Well, I think even Tampa. I mean,
that won't be an easy series. I agree.
The thing about the Lightning is, if I'm in a goal pool and I'm like looking at Lightning players and Penguins players, and I'm trying to collect guys that are going to score me goals in the playoffs, I'm picking like five Lightning players before taking anybody off of Pittsburgh. And I guess sometimes you want to have a balanced team and not know where the goals are coming from. But the thing that frightens me most about this Penguins team is that now in 21 of the 37 games that they've played without Sidney Crosby, they've scored two goals or fewer. And this is in regular season hockey, where they say that the games aren't as physically demanding and aren't as tight and aren't as defensive-oriented. So if they're having problems scoring goals in February and March, holy cow, how are they going to score in April?
You know, we're all sitting here wringing our hands about the Penguins and their power play and their scoring. And I'm not saying the Penguins are going to be the team, but the great thing about the NHL playoffs is look at last year. The Flyers had to win on the final day of the regular season, mm-hmm. number 7 seed, and they pushed the Blackhawks to the brink in the Stanley Cup final. And I think they played – Boston was a 6 seed. Am I correct? It was a 6 versus 7 in the conference final last year. So I'm not saying it's going to be the
Penguins. No, it was a 7 versus 8 in the conference final.
Oh, that's right. No, you're right,
Andrew.
It was a 7 versus 8.
I'm sorry. So I'm not saying it's going to be the Penguins, but it's not going to go to form. You're not going to have one play in four and three play in two in the Eastern Conference. It's not going
to
happen.
Of course not. And that's why after the loss to the Flyers on Tuesday – there was no reason to get down on this team, because since the lockout has happened, a number one seed out of the Eastern Conference has not gone to the Stanley Cup final, which isn't to say that it can't happen, but it is to say that the idea that home ice advantage is going to carry you through the playoffs is bunk. You know, they're shooting 0% so far since they reconfigured the league. So to lose out on home ice to the Flyers, in my opinion, in no way diminishes what they can do in the postseason. Having that 7th game at home to me means very little these days in hockey. Very little.
Well, again, when you look at also the way they've played against the top 8 in the East, not very good at 4-12.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been their problem. I want to go back to the power play. It looks like preseason out there half the time. There's no fluidity to it. It doesn't seem like there's a plan. I can't understand it.
Without Sid in the lineup, I don't understand. I was watching that game against the Lightning. Sometimes Neil was out there with the first unit. Sometimes he was with the second unit. I know he hasn't scored in regulation and he's done all of his damage in shootouts, but it's obvious to me he's one of your best forwards. See what he can do on the power play. Put him in front of the net. He was even good on the half boards against the Lightning, tracking down some loose pucks on Thursday night. So put Neil out there. I don't know if Stahl's the answer in the middle. He's probably a better guy to play on the second unit and be a penalty killer and be on your checking line. Just put your best players out there when Sid's out of the lineup and just let them have a run at it. All this tinkering they're doing with the power play, I don't see it getting them anywhere.
I think Neil's build and the way that he looks physically is misleading, because he looks to me like someone that, you know, he's bigger, he's height-wise, he's bigger than someone like Thomas Holmstrom, but you'd think his size, he would be someone that you'd station in front of the goal and he'd screen and he'd get a lot of deflections and goals that way. Just from talking to people in Dallas, that's not the type of player he was for them there. That they liked him as somebody that they set up on power plays for one-time goals and a guy that really used his slap shot. And I haven't really seen that much on the power play here. I think they've got to put him in that position where they're setting him up for one-timers. They're setting him up for shots like on the face-off circle, and they're trying to get him to finish goals that way. To me, and we've just seen this now with the 17 games that he's played played for them. He's not someone that gets his goals off of rebounds and second chances or deflected shots. And I think if they try to cast him as that, they're making a big mistake.
Well, they've got a guy on the team who's capable of doing that in Kunitz, who can play in front of the net and has played in front of the net on a power play. You're right. Neil is not the guy to do that. Neil needs a little bit of space. He has a great wrist shot. It's very quick. He gets it off in a hurry. So he needs a little bit of space. You're right, Andrew. They put him in front of the goal. They're not utilizing what he does best for them. But Kovalev they've tried him at point. He tried him on the half wall now. At some point, doesn't he go to the second unit? I don't see him doing that much, for them. He hasn't done much since he's been here.
No, they're so terrible with their entry into the zone, too. That's the one thing about Kovalev. He's actually decent at maneuvering and getting around people. So, Bosma might be having his hand forced, having to play Kovalev just for that reason, to have them gain entry to the zone. But just going back to Neil for one second, I know his strength is his shot, but his situation in Dallas is different than his situation now. They need scoring any way they can get it. He's a big guy. I would not be opposed to them, using him in front of the net on some occasions. If they have different pieces to use out by the point to get one-timers. You got to do what's best for your team, and he's a big, powerful guy. And if you have to use him in that way to score some goals when you need him, I don't see the harm in doing that with sit out.
I think Kovalev has to do his scoring with an extra man, because when they play even strength hockey, the way that they want to bring the puck into the zone and they want to get their offense going is not something that he likes to do. Mm-hmm. He's not a dump and chase player. He's not someone that's going to forecheck aggressively for you. He's just not that guy. And to ask him to turn into that player at 38 years old when his effort's been questioned everywhere is just not going to work.
He's lost his wheels, too. You could tell.
Yeah.
He is not near the same player he was even 3 years ago.
And late in the season, that really shows up. Okay, guys, up next, we're going to talk some college sports. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan. Welcome back. I'm Jerry Micco, and I'm with the Post-Gazette's Ray Fittipaldo and 93.7 The Fan evening host Andrew Filipponi. And Andrew, I'll start with you. Talk about the Final Four, which is today in Houston. And it's tough that it is for Pitt fans to see their Panthers lose to a team like Butler. Do you enjoy seeing teams like VCU and the Bulldogs kind of stick their tongue out and they beat the kind of the high-profile teams like Pitt and Florida and some of these others, Kansas? And you have this Final Four, which essentially is made up of a couple teams that nobody thought had a chance of getting there. Is this the kind of are you the kind of guy that likes this kind of thing, or do you want to see the number ones get through and play each other in these great
matches? No, I really don't. I like when the Final Four is somewhat representative of what happened in college basketball this season. And I did feel at times like if there was going to be a year where we saw a very chaotic up and down NCAA tournament, it would be this year. And, it's so funny to me because for months you hear experts and commentators say, this anything could happen in the tournament. We could see double-digit seeds. And then it comes push comes to shove and they get the brackets and they all put number one seeds in the Final Four. And it just makes me laugh. It's like, stick to your guns. You've been saying that for months. Now let's see some upsets here. So I love it. I like that VCU and Butler are in the Final Four because I feel like they're both – well, VCU is much better than I thought. But I feel like they both have the personnel based on who's left to both win a national championship. And plus, I think even though maybe more people tune out because they don't have the name recognition or brackets are busted, so now fans aren't really invested like they were before, I like when the small guy has a shot, and I think it makes college basketball, now that a lot of the NBA players are gone and are leaving earlier and earlier, that it makes it a better sport overall, because instead of five or six teams that can win the national championship, we've now probably got 30 or 40.
Well, let's bring someone in who keeps a pretty good eye on the college scene. He does it at Pitt, but he also keeps it on the national scene. Chris Peek, who is the publisher of PantherLair.com and also works here at The Fan, too, does some weekend hosting. Chris, thanks for taking the time to join us on the roundtable.
Yeah, thanks for having me. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Going well. Chris, I wanted to ask you kind of the same question. Is this kind of the kind of NCAA tournament, kind of Final Four you want to see, where you get a couple of guys? I think Andrew hit it spot on. It is a reflection of how the college basketball scene was this year, pretty up and down, and anyone could win. And here we are in the Final Four with an 11 seed, a play-in team, and an 8 seed on one side of the bracket.
Yeah, I agree with Andrew completely. I think this is what makes the tournament great. I think the great stories that come out of the NCAA tournament are stories like this. A team like an 11 seed and an 8 seed making the Final Four, and even a 3 and a 4 on the other side. I mean, I think these are the stories that, this is what makes this tournament the great event it is that anything can happen. And this year we're seeing anything happening. I mean, we're seeing things that I don't think anyone expected to have happen.
Chris, I wrote a story earlier this week about the freshmen for Kentucky and Connecticut getting so much better as the season went on. You cover recruiting for a living with Pitt basketball. Why do you think it is that maybe Jamie doesn't get the players who he feels he can play in November and December and have them grow into roles like a Jeremy Lamb did or a Brandon Knight is doing for Connecticut and Kentucky?
Well, Ray, it's interesting. I mean, there's been it's been kind of a common debate on the PantherLair.com message boards. Particularly, you mentioned Jeremy Lamb. I mean, that's a guy we see a lot here in the Big East, and as he's really come on through the Big East tournament and the NCAA tournament, people have said, "Look, you see, if Jamie had played J.J. Moore starting at the beginning of the season, this is what he could have become." And I don't know, maybe he could, maybe he couldn't, but ultimately, it comes down to the philosophy and the approach to coaching. And you know as well as I do, Ray, that it's. You've got to be able to play defense if you're going to play for Jamie Dixon. And a lot of times that rules out guys who might be able to develop into explosive offensive players as the season goes on and they get more comfortable. But the potential of having a defensive liability greatly outweighs for Jamie Dixon. It greatly outweighs the potential of having an explosive offensive player. There's been a lot of teeth gnashing and knuckle cracking about that very topic because people look at J.J. Moore and say, maybe he could be a guy who could develop like a Jeremy Lamb did and be a huge point producer once you get into the postseason. But, that's just not Jamie's philosophy, and it never has been. And, I mean, I'm sure you probably agree. I don't really see that changing all that much over the next couple of years.
I mean, we sort of laugh it off because we know Jamie's system. He's been around here for so long. But I thought J.J. Moore, from seeing him during the non-conference schedule, was one of those guys who offensively – maybe could have done something in February and March. And I know Jamie's strict system with defense first is always going to be the top billing. But, I don't know. Maybe some of those message boards posters are right. Maybe J.J. Moore could have made a difference on this team. I was on board back in November saying if Dante Taylor and J.J. Moore were not markedly better, that Pitt wasn't going to advance as far as they did last year. And they ended up going out in the same round, the second round.
Yeah, but I think you're right. I mean, this is just what he's always done. I mean, think back to Sam Young. I know there were years early in Sam Young's career where you would say, this guy's got to be a much better point producer than Levon Kendall. But Levon Kendall was an upperclassman who played good defense and better defense than Sam Young. And so the explosive offensive player stays on the bench. I think this is one thing that might bode well for Ken Burch's chances of playing next year because by all accounts, he's a pretty developed or I don't want to say polished, but he's well honed on the defensive end. That seems to be one of his strengths is playing defense. So maybe that helps him get on the court earlier. But this is his philosophy. If there's been one kind of common complaint about Jamie Dixon in light of the loss to Butler, it's that his convictions are too strong. He's too committed to his way of doing things, whether that's schematically or his approach to personnel or what have you. And this is certainly one of the things that's come under fire is this dedication and commitment to not playing players who are defensive liabilities. And even if that's a younger player who could potentially help you offensively, he's just dead set against it.
But you know what? Just like Chris looking at Butler and VCU in the Final Four, I know they're mid-major programs and Pitt wants to be in the same sentence or the same category or grouping as Connecticut and Kentucky and not the two mid-major teams in this bracket. But I would think that VCU and Butler might offer more hope for the Pitt fan because I think the way that Pitt kind of presents itself and puts its team together is probably more akin to Butler and VCU than it is Connecticut and Kentucky. You know, if Butler and VCU can get to the Final Four with upperclassmen who aren't really next-level players, then that might give Pitt the kind of hope that they can do the same thing. And it's funny that this system is kind of more like a mid-major program than it is Connecticut or Kentucky where they play freshmen and sophomores right from the jump.
Yeah, a little bit. I think there's credence to that, Andrew. I think, teams that go into the NCAA tournament with veteran players and experienced players can often, I think that maybe gets overlooked or underrated in light of all the superstars that are out there as freshmen or sophomore. But at the same time, I mean, You know, I think Butler's got some pretty talented players. The guy last year, I think, went to the NBA. I mean, you know, you still need to bring that talent in. I don't know. It's a question that's recurring of what, you know, what part of the formula is missing for Pitt? You know, how does the regular season success not carry over to the postseason? And you can look at examples, like you said, like Butler and VCU, and say, well, they're doing it this way. Pitt needs to take what it can from that formula. But then you can look at examples like Kentucky and Connecticut and say, well, Pitt needs to take some things from that formula as well. And ultimately, maybe it just comes down to having your guys play well in March, which Pitt seems to have trouble doing.
By on the roundtable by Chris Peek, the publisher of PantherLair.com. Chris, I wanted to real quick talk about some Pitt spring football while we've got you on here. And recently, Todd Graham said that the offense moved at a turtle's pace during spring workouts. You know, he wants to go more up tempo. You see practices. You talk to a lot of folks around campus. As they're constructed, is this? Can this Pitt team get there with what they've got right now?
Well, actually, it stepped up on Thursday. Jerry, Todd Graham came out and said they were at 55 miles an hour, so they hit the speed limit. So they're getting faster. But as the construction of the team, I think so. I mean, it's a matter of getting their conditioning improved and getting used to playing at that tempo, which is a physical adjustment as well as a mental adjustment. You've got to be able to think quicker than you were in sort of that slowed down dinosaur's pace offense under Dave Wanstead. But I think you can look, I mean, they've got good receivers. They've got a dynamic running back in Ray Graham. And I think those are the key components. I think Tino Sinceri will be good enough to operate this offense. And it's just a matter of getting your conditioning in order. And yeah, I mean, they're not where they want to be. They've had 8 practices so far of spring, and you can tell that the coaches wish they were further along, but there's not much you can do when you're trying to install a completely different offense and defense from what was run here before, and a completely different philosophy and tempo and all of those things. But, you know, I think the coaches can make it work with the personnel they have. It's something that'll probably take a couple of years to get, you know, perfect to 100% of where they want to be. But, you know, for the immediate future, I think they can come out and play this hurry-up offense and the, you know, attacking offense, scoring a lot of points, getting a lot of yards. I think they're built well enough. I think Dave Wanstead left enough good players in the system that they should be able to pull it off.
Chris, are you convinced that Tino's the guy, or do you think one of these younger guys might give him a run for his money?
I'm pretty convinced about it, Ray. I talked to the quarterback's coach, Todd Dodge, this week, and he more or less said that Tino's really starting to create some separation. And, you know, one thing that I don't know if we always give enough credit to when we're talking about quarterbacks is experience. And even though Tino Sinceri, I mean, he had a good year statistically in 2010, but maybe he didn't wow a lot of people, I think getting 13 games of experience under your belt can really be huge, even if it's in a different offense. Just the experience of going out and playing and leading the team, I think, can be really significant. And the coaches have said that they've seen him sort of emerge. They can tell by watching the way he carries himself and the way he practices and watches film. They can tell that he's got that experience under his belt. And then when you look at him, I mean, as far as skill set, he's a better runner than I think maybe some people give him credit for. He's not Denard Robinson, but he's not going to be expected to be Denard Robinson. And at the same time, I think his arm is strong enough to make the throws they want him to make, and he can throw pretty well on the run. I mean, he's not the perfect ideal quarterback for the offense, but I think he's good enough, and I think they'll tailor the offense to fit what his strengths are. And I think, you know, I would put it about 95% right now that Tino Sinceri is the starting quarterback in 2011.
Chris, we appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for the knowledge.
Hey, anytime, guys.
That was Chris Peek, PantherLair.com publisher. Next up, we're going to talk about the upcoming baseball season. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan. Let's go ahead and do this segment. We're going to start with the Pirates. We're talking baseball, but we're going to talk the Pirates too. And sometimes there's a disconnect. But so if you were a betting man, and I know you're not, I know you're straight, you know, you don't do this betting stuff. But if you were, you had a mortgage payment on the line, how many wins would you predict for this team? Let's say the over or under number is 67. And I guess I have to make it like 67 and a half, so you can't just pick the number. Let's say 67 and a half.
I definitely have to go under. I don't see where this team made major improvements over the offseason. You know, Kevin Correa was your opening day starter. I just don't see it. I know there's a little bit more optimism. All these young guys got a year under their belt. Presumably they're going to take a step ahead. But when I look at that pitching staff, I just don't see where the wins are going to come from.
I would agree. I think the two things that the Pirates would have to need or would have to rely on to win more than 67 games and get to 70 wins, which, by the way, they never did under John Russell, win 70 games, which is hilarious, is they would need second-year players to continue to improve. And I never really like teams that are going to depend on guys in their second year or their first full big league season. I think that's a huge risk. And they would, I think they would have to have the back end of their rotation pitch like top-end starters, because Mahalem and Correa, at this point in their careers, you know who they are. They're fourth and fifth starters. But the ability to grow and improve is based on what you get out of 3, 4, 5. Ohlendorf, McDonald, and Morton. And if you don't like those three starting pitchers, I don't think you can have high hopes for this team. And frankly, I don't really like those three guys. You know, McDonald's coming into the season a little worn out, a little beat up. Ohlendorf, for as well as he pitched in the last 2 months of the season, he seems to be going through some stuff here in the spring. And the feedback from Colin Dunlap down there and from even Clint Hurdle seemed to be extremely critical of him and his preparations for the season. And Morton, I mean, the guy was the worst starting pitcher in baseball for the first 2 months of last season. So I think they need their young starters to pitch like top-end starters, and I don't see that happening.
So I agree with that in the sense that they're relying on a lot of young guys or guys in their first full season, like – first full season, like Charlie Morton, who really last year had his first full season in the majors. I don't think he ever had a whole year up with Atlanta.
No.
And so not only are you relying on Walker, Tabata, and Alvarez in their first full season, which is a lot, and there's always that sophomore jinx thing, it is difficult to get through. Plus, their bullpen isn't as good last year as it was. I thought early in the season last year, they're getting back to the back end of the bullpen with Meek and Hanrahan was – pretty good crew. They did well late in games. I don't know if they can do that.
Well, but you know what though, Jerry, and tell me what you think about this, Ray. Forecasting bullpen performance is pointless, because I think that we've seen it enough over the years that a guy can have a huge breakout year. He signs a $10 or $15 million contract, and the next season he's got a 5 ERA. I think bullpen performance is mercurial. You look at this team last year, and we might have been having the same conversation on April 1st. They entered the year with Octavio Dotel as their closer. You didn't know what you were going to get out of Joel Hanrahan. Evan Meek was a former Rule 5 pick. DJ Carrasco and Javier Lopez were guys picked up the scrap heap, and they pitched well in the first half of the season. I think somebody like Jose Veras, who's had success in both Florida and New York, who is a guy that came in as a non-roster invitee, he might end up being the best guy in the bullpen. You can't predict it. So, you know, unless we're talking about Mariano Rivera, there are like four or five relief pitchers in baseball that are really good year to year. And everybody else, you keep your fingers crossed, I think.
Yeah.
I think bullpens matter on good teams when you have good middle relief. I think the issue with this team, though, is I think they're going to be able to score some runs. But is the starting pitching going to be able to get them to the sixth inning only giving up two or three runs for them to be in position to win a lot of games? So in that sense, I do agree with you, Andrew. The middle relief on this team probably isn't going to matter much. I think it's all how the starting pitching does that's going to be how you're going to trace how well this team does this season.
One of the biggest issues I have with their starting pitching is that with their defense last year, which was the worst fielding percentage in Major League Baseball, you can't have four or five guys that all pitch to contact. You can't do it. And that's what they had last season. No one on this team, I think, broke the 120 strikeout threshold, which is terrible. You know, especially for guys that are logging over 100 innings.
Right.
And I think that's why, you know, there is value, or there is at least potential value, in those three back-end starters, because I think Morton and McDonald have the potential to be guys who are strikeout pitchers. And that's the one thing that you can look at year to year and say, well, I know he's going to get outs this way, because defense changes, ballparks change. And a guy that has the ability to strike somebody out, he can take that to Pittsburgh, he can take that to Tampa, he can take that anywhere in the league. And I think that's what they need. They need somebody to break through and become 170, 180 strikeout guy who, you know, if you've got a putrid defense behind him, he's still going to be able to get people out.
Yeah, and it's getting those key outs for him too. So if you look at the Central Division, which is not – it might be the worst division in baseball, the NL Central. Especially with Adam Wainwright out for the Cardinals, that makes the Cardinals not as good as they would be, certainly. So, you know, could the Pirates avoid finishing last in this division this year? I mean, is Houston worse?
I've seen some forecasts where people do think the Astros are going to be worse than the Pirates. I know that's hard to believe. Watching the Pirates the last 5 to 10 years, I can't imagine another franchise being in those desperate straits. But to me, that's the sad thing about the Pirates situation. Even if you put a little bit of money into it, like the Brewers have, and the Brewers have actually put more than a little, little into it.
Yeah, they're over $70 million.
They're spending over probably the average. But it's not a hopeless situation like it is if you're the Baltimore Orioles and you're trying to compete in that division.
Oh yeah, that's murder.
If the Pirates ever get it to a point where they could at least contend in August, people around here would go nuts. It'd be great.
Oh, it'd be terrific.
I don't know if that's going to happen though.
Yeah, I think the NL Central doesn't have the 100 or 95 win team in it, but I do think top to bottom it's deeper than people give it credit for. Houston, which is I guess projected by people like Sports Illustrated and Baseball Prospectus as a 65 win team. They finished over 500 last year. I think you're hard pressed to find a more balanced outfield than Michael Bourne, Carlos Lee, and Hunter Pence in all of baseball. Brett Meyer set a record for like the most consecutive quality starts in baseball last year. They follow him up with Wandy Rodriguez, who's a good lefty, Bud Norris, Jay Happ. They've got depth in their starting pitching. I don't think they're a pick to win the division, but they seem to always have good second halves. Even when Phil Garner was there, they were a team that would come on late in the second half of the season. I know that some of the players have changed, but I think they're better than the Pirates. And, you know, really, Milwaukee went out and they bring in Zach Greinke and they didn't really give up much major league talent to get him. So I think they put at least a 15-game winner into that rotation. And I think the Cubs will be better. I mean, I know that that's a team that has basically pissed away $140 million, but I think Garza comes in as a middle rotation guy and can be another double-digit game winner for them. Zambrano was lights out in the second half of the season, and they got terrible years from guys that are pretty consistent hitters. I mean, Aramis Ramirez should not be a 245 hitter. I think they get better production from him. And I don't think there's a 90-win team in this division, but I could see three or four teams at least in this division over 400, over 500.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I just don't see them. You might be right, but you're right. There isn't one dominant team in this division. I think the Reds might be the best team in the division. Oh, the Brewers, you're right. Adding Greinke into the rotation makes them better. I really don't know if the Cubs are going to be better, and the Pirates are going to be better, but could they be worse than they were last year? I mean, they had 57 wins. I mean, I think they'll win. My number was 68, so that's why I added the half. So, but 68, but nobody says 70, right? I mean, no one's thinking 70. I mean, so 70 wins in this division might get you out of the cellar, might get you out of the cellar. But if you're, if what you're saying is true, Andrew, then if you got three teams over 80 wins, then 70 might get you in the cellar because it's very balanced then at that point.
Yeah, I think the Reds come down to earth a little bit. I don't believe in their top of the rotation pitching. Volquez is coming back from injuries. Cueto's hit or miss. Arroyo starting the year with mono. And you know, for as good as Votto was last year as an MVP, they got career year. They got a bounce back year from Scott Rolen, who played above his head offensively. He's still one of the best defensive third basemen in baseball. But that team to me doesn't have the makeup of a team that can come back and win 90 games this year.
All right, guys, I got 40 seconds. I'm going to bring our producer, Matt Popchak, in, too, on this. We're going to pick. Division winners, wild cards. Real quick, Ray, I'll start with you.
Let's see. I'll go with the Reds in the Central. The NL East, it's got to be the Phillies. And I'll go off the board here. I'll go with the Dodgers. In the
okay.
West.
Wild card?
Wild card. You know, I like the Brewers. I think the Brewers are going to be better.
You have an American League pick?
American League, I like the Red Sox to probably get there. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I like the Dodgers in the NL West because they've got a core of players that have been to the playoffs before, and I think that they're flying under the radar, and they've got that kind of ownership deal behind them. I like Milwaukee to win the NL Central because of their offense and because they've got Greinke and Markham now at the top of the rotation. I think the Phillies take the NL East, but I think the team that wins the wild card out of the division and might get to the World Series is Florida.
Oh. That's interesting. That's good. Any American League, real quick?
In the American League, I'll take the White Sox as a sleeper to get out of the AL.
Oh,
this
there
year.
You go. There you go. Matt, go ahead.
Well, in the East, I'm going to go with the Phillies, and I'm going to say the Braves definitely take the wild card. That's a pretty deep division. The West, I'll go with the Giants, but that might actually supplant the AL East as the most competitive division, top to bottom in baseball. With the Central, I feel pretty good picking the Reds. in the American League. The Boston Red Sox are the deepest team on paper in all of baseball, I think, with maybe the Yankees being a close second. So I'll take the Red Sox to ultimately win the AL pennant, and I'll take them over the Phillies in a seven-game World Series.
Well, real quick, Phillies in the East, Reds in the Central, Giants in the West, LA's the wild card. Red Sox, Twins, A's in the West. That's my kind of off-the-wall pick. Yankees are the wild card. Red Sox, Phillies, World Series. How about that? Get the Phillies back in there again. All right, guys, next up, we read fan mail. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Time now for our fan mail segment. If you'd like to have your email read on our show, please email me at jmicco@post-gazette.com. We'll consider it for a future show. This week's letter is from Teresa, who writes, "Last year, my son suffered a concussion from a fall at school. The recovery process after that was very long and uncertain. He missed a month of school and was out of any kind of sports until January. Thing is, if you talk to him, you'd never know anything was wrong. You would never know that he suffered from debilitating headaches every day or that he couldn't focus on anything for more than a few minutes. He's now completely recovered, but in Sidney Crosby's words, it's not something you can really rush. It's going to take time." Crosby's been a role model for children since he became a Penguin a few years ago, but now he's become a different kind of role model for my son. He's an amazing athlete that takes his health and well-being seriously and realizes that playing on a hockey game, even at the highest level, is not worth sacrificing your health. Thanks for that letter, Teresa. It's very good and very well put. Sidney Crosby has done so much leadership, I think, in this field just by the example he set here. And I know a lot of people, not a lot, I won't say that. I'll say there are some people out there who say, you know, how bad, you know, got football players come back in a week or they come back in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Well, some don't. And also, we've seen the effects these head injuries, multiple head injuries can have on athletes, especially in football. We're just starting to find out about it in hockey. The Post-Gazette, we did a series of stories on youth concussions at the end of 2010, looking at their impact. There is no question, I think, Sidney Crosby has shown a lot of leadership here, and he's doing the right thing. He's a young man with a tremendous future ahead of him. He is the face of the NHL. And I think he's showing everyone, he's showing athletes as well as young kids, that if you get a concussion, and it happens in contact sports, it happens in football, it happens in hockey, it can happen in baseball. Look at Justin Morneau for the Twins, just getting ready to play the season now after missing several months. It happens in all kinds of different sports, it can happen in all kinds of different ways. When you don't feel like playing, you shouldn't play. Sidney Crosby's done the right thing. I'm glad and I hope that young kids everywhere, young athletes everywhere, will take heed of what Sidney is saying and what Sidney is doing, because in the future, Sidney Crosby's the future of the NHL. Young athletes in our area are the future of Pittsburgh. So let's keep Sidney's admonition in mind that you don't play until you're ready and your health is really the most important thing you have. This has been the Post-Gazette Roundtable on 93.7 The Fan. I'm PG Sports Editor Jerry Micco. Have a great week, everyone.